is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoi, and this is The Exchange. Since the Founding Fathers created the Great Compromise at the Federal Convention in Philadelphia, the underlying premise of our Federal Republic has been equal representation with two people per state in the U.S. Senate. But centuries of westward expansion and explosive yet uneven population growth have led some to argue that small states now hold disproportionate sway in the Senate over the political fate of larger, more populous states. With big policy implications for immigration reform, climate change, earmarks and federal stimulus money, and other legislation. But others argue that without equal representation in the Senate, smaller, more conservative rural states would lose their political voice to the financial and media elite found in larger states that are more urban and liberal. The Electoral College has also been pulled into this debate, with some saying that not having the popular vote decide presidential elections creates an unfair advantage to states with larger populations, and many of those states lean left. Today on The Exchange, sizing up the small state advantage. Let's hear from you. Are you concerned that our scheme of representation in Congress is out of balance? Would you like to see changes in how the Senate functions? How about phasing out the Electoral College? Do you think New Hampshire maximizes its opportunities as a small state in the Senate? Call into The Exchange. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post your comments on our Facebook page. I have two guests joining me for the show this morning. Joining us from Maryland is Francis Lee. Francis is professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland. Francis, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you.
And also joining us from New Jersey is Stephen Macedo. Stephen is the Lawrence Rockefeller Professor of Politics and the University Center for Human Values at Princeton University. Stephen, welcome to The Exchange as well.
Nice to be with you.
Thank you. Francis, let me start with you. You've actually co-authored a book on this topic. When we say that the Senate is malapportioned, what do we mean by that? And let's hold off for a minute talking about the policy implications of that malapportionment. But what do we mean when we say the Senate has become malapportioned?
A basic principle of democratic government is one person, one vote, meaning that all citizens receive the same, each citizen receives the same amount of representation in a legislative body. And that's the basis of representation in all of the state legislatures now. And it's the basis of representation in the House of Representatives. But in the Senate, basis of representation is not one person, one vote. It is one state, two senators. And this holds regardless of the size of the state's population. And states vary wildly in the number of residents they encompass.
And so the basic idea is that essentially the power of individual senators in the Senate is out of whack with the population that they represent. Is that the idea?
That's right.
Stephen, given what Francis just said, is this what's your sense of what the founders intended by including this idea of what they call equal suffrage for all states in the Senate? Maybe a little bit of history for our listeners. If in fact this sort of Senate representation is conceivably out of whack now, and we'll talk about whether or not that's true in a moment. What did the founders initially intend here?
Sure. Well, one thing that's important to realize, and of course Francis does realize it, is that we have a federal system. The states had an identity before the national constitution was formed, and there was no possibility whatsoever at the founding of eliminating the states altogether. Indeed, they were very jealous of their powers, and it took many decades, and indeed it's still a contested matter for the states to accede to the power of the federal government. So there was simply no way that we were going to have a consolidated federal system, national system of government. The states were always going to have power, and they have an independent identity to some extent even now, independent of the national government. And the small states were, of course, afraid early on that their interests would be dominated by those of much larger states. Like New York and Pennsylvania and Virginia, so it was a necessity that the states be given some guarantee And the Senate was one of those prime guarantees in order to get people to agree to form a national union. And, of course, it was touch and go. It was just the constitutional ratification was very close, especially in some of the larger states, as it turned out. But it was a necessary concession to the independence of the states to give them this in order to assure them that their interests would be taken seriously under the Constitution. So it was a constitutional necessity, I would say, in order to get the Constitution ratified.
So this was actually a pretty big deal, though, for the states to actually commit to this. The sense was at the time that senators that this individual states were not willing to give up power to a centralized government.
Yeah, I mean, there was a general agreement that the national government had to be strengthened at the time of the founding. But how much strengthened was in great dispute, and certainly the apportionment of representation across the states. Was one major fault line. Another one was the power of the chief executive and the extent of the powers of the national government. But this was a matter of grave dispute. And it seems to me some guarantee on the part of the smaller states was absolutely necessary. Now, I might add one other thing, which is that the framers also sought to make a virtue of this necessity. I think we'll put it that way. So they sought through the Senate to create an institution that would not only represent the states on an equal basis, but that also would be designed to be deliberative in some special sense by having longer terms and being somewhat more insulated from direct popular election. Originally, the senators were chosen by state legislatures. And it was thought that that would facilitate careful deliberation about the national good in this body in particular. And it would be a salutary check on the whims and passions of the House of Representatives. So I would say that the framers took this necessity of providing some guarantees to the states and sought to make a virtue of it by creating an especially deliberative body.
Francis, you want to jump in here? Give us your sense of what was intended at the founding with this great compromise?
Well, first of all, I would quibble with the term great compromise in that, reviewing the records of the Federal Convention, there really wasn't a compromise. I mean, the term "Great Compromise" comes about later and is part of a way of justifying what happened at the convention. Rationalizing it, if you will. At the convention, there was never dispute over the basis of representation in the House of Representatives. It was under, or at least not on the basis that the idea that it should be based on population. There was some question about how the slave population should be represented in the House, but when it comes to when it came to the Senate, the debate was over whether the states should continue to have the equality that they possessed in representation, the same equality that they had at the Federal Convention itself, where voting was by state. So in the end, the large state delegates, of whom James Madison was one, he was a strong opponent of equal representation in the Senate, they just lost. They had the conceit. Now they, I agree with Steve's characterization that this was a necessary concession to bring on board the small state representatives, to bring them in, to get them to accept these new governing arrangements. I would also add, though, that I don't see it as that closely connected to federalism per se, the questions of federal versus state power. The debate over Senate representation was a debate over who would control the federal government, whatever powers it was granted. So many of the small state delegates were actually strong proponents of a stronger federal government. And, in fact, that's why the smaller states tended to be fast in approving the new constitutional system. So they just wanted to retain their power over it.
So, Francis, you're saying that this really wasn't a compromise, that essentially the smaller states really had no choice but to go along?
No. The smaller states didn't have a choice. The larger states conceded to the small states to buy their consent.
Oh, I see.
It was not they didn't get anything in exchange. Right. There wasn't a compromise. Hmm. The small state demand was equal state representation in the Senate, and their demand was met.
Oh, I see. Okay. But let's jump back up to the present now and talk a little bit about the policy implications. A lot of this debate has really revolved around the idea that In the Senate in particular, senators from individual small states, whether it's Vermont or Wyoming or New Hampshire or some other state that has a small population, perhaps a million or less, that essentially, because of the rules of the Senate and because of the nature of this malapportionment, they're allowed to obstruct or perhaps unfairly benefit legislatively from the process. So let's talk a little bit about kind of the modern case and some of the implications here. I've heard immigration mentioned. There's a stimulus money example, climate change, et cetera. Steve, can you give us an example or two to kind of explain what we mean by this unfair advantage?
Well, I mean, I think some studies that are done include sort of, and this is a general point, Francis will probably have some more specific examples, but the amount of federal spending in states on a per capita basis, and find that Wyoming, the citizens receive per capita, a premium, an additional amount beyond that of each citizen in California. So, and I can't remember the exact number there, Francis. Is it something like almost $2,000 per citizen on an annual basis, something like that?
I usually focus on it program by program.
Yeah.
There's a premium for almost all grants and aid programs.
Right.
So programs that where the federal government gives the states money and allows them to spend it on programs in the state. There's a premium for almost all of those grants and aid, and the premium is greater the more control Congress has over those funding flows. So when the funding is less discretionary, in other words, the executive branch has less influence over where monies flow, the small state advantage is greater. It's traceable back to the Senate.
So one point I have about that, and I think the work that Francis has done here, and it's been much more focused than mine, is very, very interesting indeed. If you take that that premium, that small state advantage when it comes to programmatic spending, you know, per capita, per individual, it's a lot when you look at it from the point of view of a small state, but it's not all that much when you look at it from the point of view of a big state.
We have to take a brief break, Steve and Francis, so stay with us. We're going to take a quick break now, and coming up, we'll continue talking about the small state advantage, and we'll start taking your calls as well. So please stay tuned.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. Foodstuffs is a new series from NHPR. We're exploring the state's farms and restaurants, meeting the people who are putting new flavors on our plates and bringing new ideas to our food system. Don't miss Foodstuffs every week on All Things Considered, and check out our regular blog posts on NHPR.org. More on sizing up the small state advantage on the exchange, then at 10 o'clock in the Diane Rehm Show, how sequestration is affecting Americans. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from New Hampshire Orthopedic Center, keeping bodies in motion on the web at nhoc.com. From North Branch Construction, 54 years experience building custom homes to multi-million dollar eco-friendly commercial buildings on time, on budget, online at Facebook, LinkedIn, and northbranch.net. And Fuller Gardens, located on the seacoast in Northampton, New Hampshire, where visitors can enjoy an estate botanical garden 7 days a week, online at fullergardens.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today on The Exchange, we're discussing the small state advantage in the Senate and the Electoral College. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477 or send us a short email to exchange@nhpr.org, and you can also post a comment on our Facebook page. I have two guests with me today, Francis Lee, who's a professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland, and Stephen Macedo, who's the Lawrence Rockefeller Professor of Politics at Princeton University. And Steve, we ran out of time there briefly, but let's pick up with what you were saying about the sort of particular example of this imbalance in the amount of money that the individual states get from the Senate.
Yeah, I was just saying that if you look at it from the point of view of a small state, with a small population, it looks like a fairly significant amount of money per person. It could run into the few thousands per year. But if you look at it from the standpoint of a much larger state with a much larger population, and California has about 90 times as many people as Wyoming, somewhere in that neighborhood, it isn't all that much per person. The people of California from that larger state are not losing all that much per year. It's more in the few hundreds of dollars, and in some cases it's quite small. Also, if you look at what the programs are that have a small state advantage when it comes to spending, one of the biggest ones, I recall, and I think from Francis's book, is transportation. Well,
yes.
You know, we had an original constitutional commitment to settling the entire country. The Constitution includes a provision that the federal government's responsible for building post offices and postal roads across the entire country. And that was seen as vitally important to creating a nation, to building communication across the entire nation, and inevitably delivering the mail, facilitating communication, building roads, and so on, is going to be far more expensive in less populous states, especially when they're geographically quite large as they are out west. So it seems to me that in some instances, these discrepancies between big and small state spending have a reasonable rationale, and they're part of our national commitment to building one nation.
So, Francis, I saw this figure that the top five states receiving per capita federal stimulus money all have one representative in the House, essentially suggesting that they're some of the smallest states in the nation. Is this a problem? Or as Steve says, if you look at it in a somewhat different light, it's actually not that big of a deal.
Well, it is typical. And the way these small states derive such strong advantages in the per capita distribution of federal funds, it typically plays out with a small state minimum. That's what's referred to in the formulas for distributing funds that Congress writes. So it's common that all states will be guaranteed at least half of 1% of the total allocation for the program. So whatever the program is, it might be anti-terrorism money, or it might be transportation or community development or environmental quality or whatever. For the total amount, no state will get less than half of 1%. A way of thinking about that is, there are 50 states. If you were to distribute the money equally by state, so with Wyoming getting the exact same amount as California, that would be 2% per state. So half of 1%, it means a quarter of the money is being distributed equally across states. And so that's where you see these big boosts in the very smallest states. Now, I would agree with Steve that we should think about this as a concentrated benefit for small states at a dispersed cost for the rest of the nation, meaning that it's not very expensive on a per capita basis for the United States to overfund small states with small populations. If you take California's allocation and cut it by $1 per capita, that's a huge amount of money that then would provide a boost of many dollars on a per capita basis in the small states. And so it's a big boost for the small states, but the reason why this is not an issue that generates a great deal of public outrage is because it's relatively cheap to overfund the small states.
So Steve, why is this happening? Is it a function of the kind of design of the Senate, or the kind of the functioning of the Senate, or is it that these small states have really good senators who know how to play the system, maybe the late great Robert Byrd of West Virginia, who every second building in West Virginia is named after him, brought a lot of money home to the state, or Bernie Sanders is an example I've seen recently in Vermont, bringing home a lot of money per capita for the state. Why do you think this is happening now?
Well, there's no doubt that representatives from small states are looking out for small state interests. That is part of democracy. And if you look at the list of Senate majority leaders, say, over the last 30, 40 years, they include lots of small state senators who have a lot of seniority and are able to take a leadership role. And no doubt those positions are always used to the advantage of people at home. Now, seniority plays a huge role in the Senate and in the House with respect to these sorts of things as well, and that's also distributed on a somewhat arbitrary basis. So there's no doubt that's part of it, that the small states will use this advantage. I don't want to say that there isn't any democratic problem here at all. It just seems to me that this discrepancy in spending across the small and the large states is not high up on our list of national problems, and moreover, the unequal representation on a population basis, by states in the Senate, doesn't contribute in a major way, it seems to me, to our major problems, which include hyper-partisanship and gridlock in Washington. I just don't think that the small state issue was one of the prime contributors to the main problems that face this country.
Francis, anything in your mind about the structure of the Senate? You know, we can talk about the filibuster, but just in general, that allows these individual senators to kind of either, you know, bend the process to their state's advantage or, you know, obstruct legislation, whether it's climate change or immigration or some other policy.
Well, it doesn't take a great deal of skill for senators representing these small states to benefit from the system. You know, they are sought out as coalition partners when it comes to building support for distributing federal funds. When a coalition leader needs to put together a formula to distribute money to the states, which is how most federal money is distributed, on at least in a grant, in terms of grants and aid by formula. When they were building a coalition, these states are cheap. There's often a bidding war to get them into the coalition. So they just wait it out. They don't have to be, you know, enormously skillful. Like, they don't have to be like Senator Byrd was in bringing funds home for West Virginia. It's it's sort of baked into the cake. It's a built-in advantage that they enjoy. Now, we're able to track it nicely in the area of federal spending because we have a nice metric. We can look at how much states get relative to one another, and we can see the advantage that the small state overrepresentation produces there. Now, I'm sure it works in other policy areas as well that, you know, don't involve spending per se or that involve matters of priorities, but it's harder to track there. I mean, it's worth also pointing out that Senate representation has the effect of diluting the power of racial and ethnic minorities in Congress. That the typical state is much wider than the nation as a whole. You know, many of the smallest states have populations that are 90% or more non-Hispanic white, whereas the nation as a whole is just around 63% non-Hispanic white. So there's an effect there. Urban areas are weaker in the Senate than they are in the nation as a whole. So there are other types of interests that are affected by Senate representation, but it's harder to measure the precise nature of those effects than it is in the area of federal spending. So a lot of the research is focused on federal spending because it's measurable.
Right, that's right. Right. Today on the Exchange, we're talking about sizing up the small state advantage. And you can join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And we have an email from Dean, interestingly enough. And Stephen, this is something that I wanted to talk to you about, because I've heard you say that, or read that you've said that gerrymandering in the House of Representatives, these creative designing of congressional districts within the states, is actually a bigger problem, something that we should be more concerned about. And it's something that I've always thought is quite problematic in the House. And it seems like a significant structural problem. So our emailer, Dean, was also writing in and asking about the impact of gerrymandering in the House and how it distorts outcomes in Congress. So can you talk a little bit about that issue?
Yeah, no, and I think it's a good comparison, because often when one looks at which of the two houses is the greater problem with respect to obstructing what looks like useful national legislation, it's often the House rather than the Senate, though not always. And indeed, in the last election, if you look at the popular votes that were cast for members of the House, the Democrats won overall nationally by about a million votes, I think. And yet the Republicans retained control of the House and have a substantial, it's not a huge majority, but a substantial and certainly working majority in the House of Representatives. And part of the reason for that is indeed, as the emailer said, that the Republicans control, quite a number of state legislatures, and state legislatures are in charge of, and governors are in charge of districting. So this has been used to create a few districts with huge numbers of Democrats, and many more districts where Republicans are able to win by smaller majorities and thereby capture a larger number of seats. So indeed, I think that nonpartisan districting would be a significant contribution to good government in the states. And,
what are the chances of do you think of that actually happening?
Well, it's come close in a couple of places. In California, it almost passed, and it was defeated in part because it was linked to redistricting outside the 10-year cycle, and that was seen as a kind of partisan, an attempt by the party in power to gain a partisan advantage sort of midterm. I think that, let's put it this way, it has a greater chance of being enacted than a constitutional amendment to change the apportionment
sure.
of senators.
Sure, we'll talk about that in a minute, whether this can be changed. Right.
But I think that if the public were more concerned about this, then it could easily be done. And it has been debated in a number of states, and it would be good. It's not going to revolutionize our system. The problems of American democracy in many respects are deep-seated, and there aren't any easy fixes. But partisan districting makes no sense, and we're virtually the only country in the world that does it this way. It makes no sense to give the politicians in power the opportunity to draw district bounds.
Yeah, Francis, is this a bigger concern for you than the malapportionment in the Senate?
No, it's not. But I certainly agree that it raises serious questions of democratic responsiveness when politicians are able to effectively choose their own voters, which is what happens with the politicized redistricting that we use. And it is certainly more amenable to reform than Senate apportionment is. I would observe, though, that it's important to remember that that partisanship and partisan conflict polarization has risen in both House and Senate simultaneously. So you often hear gerrymandering described as a key cause of party polarization, meaning they draw districts that are safe for one party or the other.
Well,
and then
basically what I hear from voters is that there's no one left in the House to compromise with in terms of bipartisanship.
Yes, that's what they say. But it's interesting that you have had the rise of partisanship in the Senate at the same time and at the equivalent an equivalent increase.
Is that unusual to you, to have the Senate be more partisan?
Well, it's that there's no gerrymandering in the Senate. And so gerrymandering cannot be a cause of the increased partisanship in the Senate.
What do you think is causing it?
Well, in other words, it goes beyond gerrymandering. And so, it relates to the interest groups that control nominations in the parties, whether the nomination happens in a safe congressional district or in a state. This notion that gerrymandering is at the root of party polarization in the House, I think, is misguided. I think there are a lot of reasons to be concerned about gerrymandering, but that's probably not you're probably not on good ground or solid ground to describe polarization as a consequence of partisan gerrymandering.
Let's talk. Go ahead, Steve. You can jump in.
I was going to say I agree with Francis on that. I don't think there. It would be worth having nonpartisan districting for a variety of reasons, including it's simply an unlovely spectacle, as Francis said, to have legislators choosing their own constituents. But it wouldn't revolutionize our politics. Though I do think the House polarization in the House is worse than in the Senate.
My question to Francis was, why are some people say we're seeing a more polarized and unusually kind of partisan Senate? And I was wondering, you know, why that's the case. Is it just a function of the larger political culture in the country, or is there some structural reason for it?
Well, I think, as she was suggesting, relatively few citizens show up in primary elections, and citizens in Republican primaries in particular. Citizens on the relatively far right have been especially energized and have been nominating candidates who are considerably to the right of the median Republican voter and have moved the party, to the right. Now, this has happened on the Democratic side as well, though the evidence tends to suggest it's happened to a greater extent on the Republican side. So I think it's partly the primary system.
The primary system, yeah.
But, of course, a few senators were nominated by, Tea Party activists in part in the last cycle, and they turned out to be too far to the right for the electorate. So the Republicans have probably lost five, six Senate seats over the last couple of elections as a consequence of nominating candidates that are too far to the right. So there are corrections for it. I wanted to come back to one thing, if I may, that
sure.
Francis mentioned, which I thought was an important point, that the small state advantage tends to make things worse for for cities and for poorer people in cities. And I think there is some effect in that direction. Though I would say this, I think, that of course the Democrats tend to be the party that stands for greater spending for social programs and tends to be much more in favor of spending on the less well-off, just as a matter of fact, than the Republicans. And one strange feature of this small state advantage, which I think is one of the reasons why people don't regard it as big a problem as it might be, is if you look at the small states that are advantaged, there are conservative small states and there are liberal small states. So there isn't a strong partisan bias when it comes to the small state advantage. If we look at it this way, Obama and McCain in that election split the 16 smallest states, 8 each. I didn't look at it for Romney and Obama, but I bet it was similar. So it isn't the case that the small state advantage is systematically, you know, advantaging one party rather than the other.
So this idea, you know, we have this dichotomy that people often talk about between the small rural conservative states and the big yeah. urban liberal states, that's an unfair caricature is what you're saying.
Well, if you look at the small states for every Wyoming, there tends to be a Vermont. And likewise, at the big state end, for every New York or California, there's a Texas, or another larger small state, Ohio and Florida to some degree. So there hasn't been a huge partisan. It doesn't represent a huge partisan bias. One of the big divides.
There is a partisan bias. It's just not huge.
It's not huge. That's correct.
Right. Yeah,
that's
so it's overstated.
Yeah.
Well, right. That's right. I mean, and of course, Democrats have wound up overperforming in some of these smallest states. You know, Heidi Heitkamp wins in North Dakota, despite the fact that Obama loses that state by 20 percentage points. And if you look at the Senate delegations from some of those Western Plains states, it's surprising. You know, that Montana's got 2 Democrats. Mm-hmm. Alaska even has 1. North Dakota, South Dakota each have 1 Democratic senator. And so you wouldn't expect, based on the presidential voting, that those states should be able to sustain Democratic senators, but they do. And so there is a tilt. It is consistent over time. It tends to advantage Republicans, but it's easily overstated. One also needs to remember that there are blue states that are small, that are overrepresented in the Senate.
We have to take one more break now. We come back. I want to talk about the filibuster. We'll talk about the Electoral College. So stay tuned, and we'll take your calls as well.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Company C, creating a lifestyle of colorful living with brightly colored area rugs, bedding, furniture, and home accents. Retail store in Concord and online at CompanyC.com. And Plymouth State University offering new graduate education programs, including 18 MED, MAT, and Postmaster's higher education option, registering now for summer term. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
Alex Ray, owner of The Common Man and NHPR underwriter.
Way back, probably over 15 years ago, I supported NHPR because I personally liked it. Today, I support it because the public actually says to me, I like doing business with The Common Man because you support my love, which is NHPR. And that's enough for me to believe that we're getting a very good return on our contribution.
Find out how you can become an NHPR underwriter by visiting the support page at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Tomorrow on The Exchange, turmoil in Turkey. Email us your questions before the program at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9 a.m. Today we're talking about the disproportionate power of small states in the current system of political representation. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. And joining me today to discuss this are two guests, Francis Lee, Professor of Government and Politics at the University of Maryland, and Stephen Macedo, the Lawrence Rockefeller Professor of Politics at Princeton University. And I want to pick up now, sort of wrap up talking about kind of the Senate and move on to talking about the Electoral College. But let's talk for a moment about the Senate filibuster. It seems to be the bane of many a member of Congress and citizen who wants to see some sort of legislative action. Steve, let's start with you. Is the filibuster a problem? And if so, what do we do about it?
Well, I mean, it can be a problem, this flows from the rules of the Senate, and the Senate could change its rules on the first day of its session. Often, of course, complaints about the filibuster depends upon, you know, who's doing the filibustering and for what cause. Now, often it is used for causes that, you know, that are unjust. Certainly the Southerners for many decades were able to block civil rights legislation by threats or actual filibusters. Or in the case of civil rights, they were able to slow it down until Lyndon Johnson came around. But in other cases, liberals are able to use filibusters to block, you know, threats of things like privatization of Social Security, say, or causes dear to their hearts. So, you know, there is certainly grounds for thinking that both the filibuster and the Senate practice of putting holds on nominees to the executive branch and slowing down judicial nominations has gotten out of hand. Thomas Mann and Norman Ornstein have written about the breakdown of regular order in Congress since the mid-1990s. So I think there are reasons to be concerned, and indeed Harry Reid did make noises about changing the filibuster rule at the beginning of the recent session. There is no question that one of our major national problems is that we have very polarized elites in Washington who are far more polarized than the American public, than the American voters are. And it does make deliberation about national issues, you know, very difficult. You know, thinking about reforms to the filibuster as it has been changed sometimes over our history may be one way, maybe one thing to think about. But certainly curbing the practice of using the filibuster much more regularly than it had been in the past, and this practice of holds as well, is something worth thinking about.
Right, and I think the polarization you talk about gets back to our early comments about gerrymandering and the primary system, et cetera. Francis, what do you think? The filibuster a problem, and if so, what do we do?
The filibuster is used in new ways now. You know, the notion that the filibuster is a minority party veto, that emerges in the 1990s. You know, prior to that, the filibuster was used for regional concerns. Steve mentioned civil rights and opposition to civil rights. That was, that was the primary way in which the filibuster had been used for a long stretch of U.S. history. And then beyond that, it was used by individual senators for their personal causes. But the notion that the filibuster should effectively be an opportunity for a minority party, anytime the minority party has 40 seats or controls 40 seats in the Senate, to obstruct across the board the majority's agenda, that's a new use of the filibuster, and it does raise new problems of gridlock. And over time, you know, this puts a great deal of pressure on the continuation of the filibuster, and you hear more threats from Senate leaders, both parties, when they're in the majority, with more and more frequency, threatening to adjust Senate rules. And so one wonders whether it is sustainable over a long period of time if the filibuster is going to be used in this new way.
And it doesn't seem like there's, you know, there's always talk about reforming it, but it seems like, you know, senators find it useful when it serves their purposes. So they're a little bit loath to tinker with it too much.
Right, right. So it takes a great provocation to get a change.
The Electoral College, big topic. I often hear from voters who say we should just really do away with it and go by the by the popular vote. Steve, what do you think about that? Do you think it's ever going to happen? Do you think it makes sense?
Well, it would be difficult to change, and I think that it would not be worth all the effort that we would put into it. I mean, one thing to keep in mind is there is no national contest for the popular vote. So it's a bit of a meaningless statistic to say that someone won the popular vote. In the 2000 election, say, there were many states in which a candidate Bush was very far ahead and had no particular incentive to get out more voters because it was assured that he was going to win Texas, say, and a variety of other states. So when one counts up the popular vote across states, it doesn't really mean anything because under the current rules, the candidates are not engaged in a contest over the national popular vote. We don't know what the outcome of the popular vote would be if there were a contest over the national popular vote. So I think that it can be a meaningless statistic. And look, the other problem is that in the event of a close election, of course, we had a great controversy over the vote counting in Florida in 2000. Sure. But if we're in a close national election, you could have concerns about votes in any part of the country, and there could be a contest over the election taking place all over the country as a consequence of a very close national vote total. So we'd have to establish national standards for elections nationwide as well if we were to do it on the basis of a popular vote, and that would take control of elections away from the state. So it would require a whole series of changes. I don't think it would make all that much difference, and at least I do want to emphasize that it's kind of a meaningless statistic to point out that someone got a higher popular vote total and because there isn't a contest for it at the moment.
So, Steve, in comparison to the founders, is there a reason why we still need to have this Electoral College?
Well, it doesn't. It's I would say at this point it's part of according to the state's control over elections. So it sort of reflects it does reflect certainly the apportionment of representation in the Senate and the House. But it's part of the federal system of giving states control over the electoral apparatus. And there are some advantages in keeping control of elections in the hands of local people. There may be some democratic functions to that. But certainly the Electoral College does not engage in the kind of deliberative functions that the framers originally thought they ought to do. I mean, originally they really thought that the Electoral College should engage in deliberation about the chief executive, and that never functioned the way that they had thought it would. So it doesn't play a very large role. It's more of an accounting mechanism at the moment.
Francis, how do you weigh in on this? Do we need to tweak the system? Should we switch to direct vote? You know, I hear so many Democrats say, well, Al Gore really won in 2000 because he got more votes. How do you feel about that statement?
Well, I agree that it's really not appropriate to tally up all of the votes cast for president nationally and say this is the national vote, because we don't have a campaign fully waged across the nation. The campaign tends to be waged in the swing states, and then there are safe states there might as well be no presidential election when it comes to the efforts to get out the vote or to advertise. I think there are certainly problems with that. You know, there seems something wrong. I live in the state of Maryland now, work in the state of Maryland, and Maryland is not in play in presidential elections. And so it's, candidates don't visit here. There's not much interest taken. The focus in presidential elections are in those handful of large swing states. I see it as quite separate from the whole issue of small state advantage in the Senate, in that it's true that small states do get a boost in the Electoral College, but the contest in the Electoral College is over the larger swing states. And so it concentrates the presidential election in a relative handful of places. So it fails to engage voters throughout wide swaths of the U.S. I find that troubling. Certainly, the Electoral College does not function the way the framers had envisioned it would. One of the less carefully considered aspects of the Constitution, one that we are apparently stuck with, and very difficult to reform that as well.
Let's take a call. Augusta, joining us from Hanover. Augusta, welcome to the Exchange. Augusta appears not to be with us. So, Francis, just to kind of bring the discussion around to kind of practical political terms, the argument I often hear is that Republicans would never allow an abolishment of the Electoral College because, the big urban centers tend to be more Democratic. Is that a fair statement?
It certainly is true that the big urban areas are more Democratic. I'm not sure that would be a decisive advantage for Democrats in presidential elections if we had a national
in
vote.
In terms of total number of voters, that there's these big urban populations, millions of people who tend to vote Democratic, and then you have the rural West and the rural South that tend to be more Republican.
Right, the way in which the Electoral College adjusts that is not all that important for the functioning of the Electoral College. That the Western states and some of the smaller states that get a little extra boost in the Electoral College. That's not the main function of the Electoral College, is through the unit rule, which is where a whole a state casts all of its electoral votes for the candidate that receives the plurality, the popular vote in the state. And so that makes the contest focused in the larger states. I mean, the Electoral College, the battle for the Electoral College vote happens in the larger states that swing. So, you know, it's going to be in Ohio, and it's going to be in Florida.
Right. Well, New Hampshire listeners like to think that, you know, our four electoral votes are often decisive.
New Hampshire has a special status in the presidential election.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that in a moment. Steve, let me ask you a question. You know, so there are a couple states now where you have electoral votes essentially awarded by congressional district. Is that a smart move, or does that not really deal with the issue?
Well, that would be one way of helping to nationalize the campaign. And Francis has a point there. It would be good to encourage candidates to campaign more widely across the country. And if they wanted not only to win a state, but to win it by a large margin, so that they would gain a greater proportion of the electoral votes for that state, that's one reason to do it. And indeed, there are proposals to allocate electoral votes by giving sort of two votes to the statewide winner that would represent the Senate seats, and then allocating the other seats on a proportional basis. I mean, I would make one point about all of these proposals, which is that it's very easy to see the problems of the current system because we're living under it. Proposals for constitutional reform often will contain their own new problems, which are hard to see until we live under them. So, it's conceivable that if we move to a national popular vote, that the incentive of candidates would shift to, you know, getting out their bases, rather than trying to persuade people in the middle. I don't know what the consequences would be, but no doubt there would be a downside to it, which will only become apparent after we've enacted the reform. I don't mean to be too skeptical, but it's always the problems of the current system are obviously far more visible than the problems of a reform system.
And we have Augusta back now from Hanover. Augusta, we're a little short on time, but we'd love to have your question.
I just thought it'd be interesting historically to notice that the gerrymandering was named after Elbridge Gerry, who was vice president of the U.S. At the time, and he invented it, shape of the district, so it looked like a salamander, so they called it a gerrymander. And, of course, we don't pronounce it that way anymore. And there are three states who allocate their electoral votes in the same proportion as their popular votes. And Pennsylvania is having a big battle over that now.
So Steve, following up on what you're saying, Francis, how do you – Augusta essentially raising this issue of proportional allocation within states. Is it a good idea?
It depends on how it's designed. I mean, certainly if you were to go to a system where the contest happens by congressional district, that would have quite a marked – Republican advantage because of the way in which congressional districts are currently drawn, something that Steve mentioned earlier in our discussion, that the Democrats tend to be heavily packed into a relatively small number of congressional districts, having to do with, you know, the fact that urban areas are very Democratic, and so the urban districts give their votes to Democrats in large by large margins, and so Republicans are more efficiently distributed across congressional districts. So if you were to go to a system that allocated electoral votes by congressional district, that would have a noticeable Republican tilt. And it is Republicans who are primarily pushing for that. And they're primarily pushing for it in states where the statewide vote goes Democratic, but there are more congressional seats that are held by Republicans, states like Florida or Pennsylvania. You would see, you know, that would be very advantageous for Republicans to shift from a statewide vote to a vote by congressional district.
And Augusta, thanks for your call. We only have a few minutes left, but before we finish, I want to ask you both about one special aspect of the small state advantage that keeps both Iowa and New Hampshire in the public eye. It's a presidential primary. Your kind of opinions on the way the cycle runs right now and whether or not it makes sense to have two small states at the front of the process. Steve, why don't you go first?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, there could be a worse system. I'm sure there could be many worse systems, and it's not that it works out terribly. I would say it doesn't make a huge amount of sense, and I think one of the main problems we have is that the presidential electoral cycle is just way too long. We're starting off in January, And there are several episodes of intense interest. And in between, citizens forget what they've learned over the course of the electoral cycle. So I think it ought to be, if possible, it should be made much more compact so that rather than a 9-month presidential election cycle with vast swaths of nothing happening in between exciting episodes, it's made much more compact so that the election takes up less of our political time, but also becomes a more effective learning tool for citizens and a more effective mm-hmm. political debate.
Frances, real quick, what do you think?
Oh, certainly no one would design a system that is that looks like the one that has grown up. I mean, there are reasons to criticize the outsized role that New Hampshire and Iowa enjoy. They're not very representative states in lots of capacities. It means that, in the case of Iowa, presidential candidates all have to make promises about farm programs that might not be a good idea from the vantage point of the nation as a whole.
Yeah.
So, no one would design it this way. It has some virtues, but rationality is not primarily one of them.
Well, you've both been reasonably gracious in your comments about our primary. You'll probably be getting a few emails from people, but we love the primary here. We are out of time. Yeah, this sounds like this is an issue without any easy solutions, and it certainly stirs up a lot of passion. I'd like to thank my guests for a provocative hour, an interesting hour. Frances, thanks so much for joining us and for your expertise on the subject.
Thank you.
That's Frances Lee. She's professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland. And Steve, my thanks to you also. We really appreciate your insights.
Thank you very much indeed.
That's Stephen Macedo. He's the Lawrence Rockefeller Professor of Politics in the University Center for Human Values at Princeton University. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm.